Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with Chicago indie label Cranky Records co-founder and author Bruce Adams. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll talk about the label's history, aesthetic, and more. But first, some new music from Iggy Pop and Ladytron.
That is a little bit of a track called Frenzy that kicks off the new album from James Osterberg, the 19th studio album of Iggy Pop's career, Mr. Kot, Every Loser. You know, does Iggy Pop even need an introduction? Three albums with the Stooges between 1969 and 1973 laid the groundwork, along with a handful of others. It's often said, as an exaggeration, you know, godfather of punk, but Stooges and the Velvets, man. That's where punk rock came from. Immortal, those albums. And then a long solo career. Two solo albums produced by David Bowie, Idiot and Lust for Life, and many, many since. Iggy is working this time with producer Andrew Watt. He's got a band that includes Duff McKagan, Guns N' Roses on bass, Chad Smith, Red Hot Chili Peppers on drums, various guests popping in and out, Pearl Jam, Stone Gossard, and the late Taylor Hawkins, drummer Travis Barker. Let's just dive in. If you don't know Iggy by this point, here is a track called Strung Out Johnny, Iggy in a little more lower key mode, from Every Loser on Sound Opinions.
Love becomes compulsive. It's wiser to say no. God made me a junkie, but Satan told me so. You're strung out, Johnny, and you can't get away. You're strung out, Johnny, and now it's time to pay.
That is Strung Out Johnny from Iggy Pop's new record, Every Loser. You know, Iggy's been talking about retiring for a number of years. And
76 he's going to be in April. 76.
Right. Every few years he comes up with a record. He seems to be still fairly prolific. Still people want to record with him, and he continues to make records, which I'm not complaining about. I mean, this record, Every Loser, He's really singing about himself, and he's including a lot of other people who have felt like outsiders their entire life. I mean, his whole career has been based on that persona, that I am not like everybody else. I am out here on my own. I'm doing my own thing. It took him a long time to get recognition for it. Here I am. I'm still standing. That's the basic premise of basically every one of those solo records in some ways, you know?
No, still standing and more ripped than a 20-something bodybuilder.
Well, yeah, and you know, there's always with Iggy, I think, underrated as a lyricist, you know, some of the lines you kind of cringe at, but there's other lines that are just...
some?
That are funny, and you know, he I have to say, I look at these lyrics, and the first time you kind of go, huh? And then other, you know, as you sort of get into the mindset of Iggy, which is, you know, one of a kind.
Yeah.
There's a language there that's all his own. Only Iggy sounds like Iggy. So I think there's something to be said about that. You know, modern day ripoff. These songs where he's kind of cranky, complaining about stuff. But, you know, it's funny. I ran out of blow a long time ago. I can't smoke a J or my guts fly away. You know, it's like he's mourning the fact that he can't do drugs anymore.
Yeah, and neo-punk, he's mocking the kids who would dare call themselves punk.
And,
yeah.
And New Atlantis, that ode to Miami, a beautiful whore of a city, as he calls it. You know,
somewhere south of Alabama and north of Cuba, there lies a beautiful whore of a city. She accepts all donations and attracts an endless stream of lovers.
The thing about this record, and...
What is the thing, Greg?
The thing about this record that bothers me is, A, you mentioned the guest list. I don't get that.
No.
Why? Why Dave Navarro? Why Eric Avery? Why, you know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers? Why Josh Klinghoffer? Tuff McGagan? Stone Gossard's on the record?
Yeah.
The late Taylor Hawkins? I hear about these guys. Andrew Watt's kind of like this generation's answer to Brendan O'Brien. You know, he's kind of the producer to the rock stars, you know. I mean, it sounds like, you know, a boilerplate rock record that could have been made by anybody.
Overproduced.
And, you know, at this point, I'm wondering why Iggy bothers with making a record like that. You know, I thought the record that he did with Josh Homme a few years ago, that post-pop depression record, was a good record and kind of in the vein of Iggy not only being Iggy, but also sounding like no one but himself.
Mm.
And on this record, Iggy sounds like a million other, you know, generic rock vocalists, fronting a generic supergroup type of band.
So you were talking about the lyrics.
It's disappointing.
You know, that voice is amazing. Nobody else could take a line like, no fun, my babe, no fun, and make it sound as profound as Iggy Pop. That is a long time ago, Greg. Listening to this album quite a bit to get ready to review, I came to a sad realization. I pretty much hate Iggy Pop's solo career. The last album, beginning to end, that I enjoyed was Zombie Birdhouse.
Well, that's a long time ago.
1982, all right? You know, since then, now to be sure, there are a handful of brilliant tracks in Iggy's solo career. Passenger, Lust for Life, but for every song like that, there are four, like Loco Mosquito. Remember that one?
Yeah, no, I do remember it. I mean, he can some of the song choices, some of the ideas are way off base, and that's where you need a good collaborator. You know, when he's worked with Bowie, I think he's come up with some of his best work.
Yeah,
Josh Homme,
Bowie
you know, understood him
you know,
pretty well.
Homme, that record was okay, but it was not great. You know, the Two Stooges reunion records were pretty abysmal. You know. And you go and you see Iggy, and he's still one of the most amazing performers you'll ever see in your life in the rock realm, just intensity personified, and you wait for the good songs, right? You wait for Lust for Life. You wait for anything from the Stooges.
Well, that's what he pretty much plays when he's in concert,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
He does play. He does know where his good stuff is.
So like the Rolling Stones, why go through the charade of a new album when you really don't have anything new to say? It's overproduced. Doesn't sound like Iggy. He's not stretching as a vocalist. You know, and I really don't need him to stretch because those couple of cabaret albums he put out, we have a few tracks like that here. We have three interludes.
Yeah.
You know, one where he's reading like commercial ad copy that he heard on the radio or something.
Yeah.
We will work with the referral source to come to a consensus diagnosis
and a treatment plan that will allow you to feel better, faster.
What are you doing, James? Come on, man.
That is the title track from the new Ladytron album, Time Zero, the seventh album from this quartet, co-ed quartet, formed in Liverpool, England in the late 90s, 2001 debut album. You know, when they first came out, Jim, they were a real breath of fresh air on the electronic scene. Ladytron, obviously, borrowing their name from a great track
Roxy Music,
and carrying on in that spirit. They were loosely affiliated with that electroclash movement in the early 2000s. Felix the House Cat, Miss Kitten,
Fisher Spooner,
Peaches was in there a little bit, Princess Superstar. You know, pop sensibility with a certain theatricality and humor, but I always thought they never really fit into that.
No.
They sort of carved out their own lane. And Time's Arrow, named after a Martin Amis novel, I think, again, emphasizes that they are unique in the electronic realm over the last couple of decades. Now, this is the first album. They put out a record in 2019 and a self-titled record. That was their first one in almost a decade. I mean,
yep.
They had been taking some time off to work on solo projects. So now they're back. Let's hear what they've got for us. This is a track called City of Angels from the new Ladytron record, Time's Arrow, on Sound of Freedom.
City of Angels by Ladytron. The album is called Time's Arrow. Greg, Ladytron's never taken a misstep as far as I'm concerned. I love this band. The electroclash thing early on, they've often said, we had nothing to do with that, right? They were worshiping at the altar of Kraftwerk,
yeah.
All right?
And Roxy Music.
And Roxy Music.
Early New Wave.
Bringing some of the glam into that analog synthesizer sound, which I'm a sucker for, when combined with great pop hooks. And, you know, the two DJ producers, Daniel Hunt and Ruben Wu, craft fantastic musical settings, wonderful pop songs for the vocalists, Helen Marney and Mira Arroyo. The way those two women sing together, the way they bring warmth and sensuality to a sort of icy cold forebodingness, mm-hmm. right? You know, that is partly the electronic instrumentation, but also, you know, this is a soundtrack for, you know, the next five Blade Runner sequels
yeah.
or remakes. You know, it always has been. And when the songs are as strong as the Dreamers, or California, a loving homage to that state, or the title track. You know, it's a really wonderful pop ride, and it's a great sound. I try not to have the bias for those electronic sounds. There's a couple of songs that actually really have the primitive early Kraftwerk drum sounds,
mm-hmm.
right? When those guys were playing with what looked like knitting needles on a flat board, triggering drum. You know,
right.
but that has become a musical vocabulary in and of itself. Kraftwerk was using those instruments because that's what existed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a charm. They have a quirkiness that modern synthesizers and drum machines don't have. So to make music like this, I mean, it's like somebody today writing for a chamber orchestra, intentionally loving the sounds of those instruments and trying to bring new life to them.
I think they were unique, and definitely an outlier in that whole electroclash thing. They were in a category by themselves because of the songcraft. The attention to the hooks and the melodies were always a part of what they did. It wasn't sort of a flamboyant theatricality that they were emphasizing. It was more about traditional values coupled with, as you mentioned, this love of those sounds from the pioneers of electronic music, combined with a very forward-looking perspective on songwriting. And, you know, this record brings them right up to date. You know, when you talk about Time Zero, they're really looking at life. I mean, they've been a band for 20-plus years now.
Yeah.
They started out this a band when they were kids.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're sort of in midlife, and this record is about looking at a perspective. Like, I love that song City of Angels, because
yeah,
I get the image of them in the City of Angels in L.A. If you're in L.A., you're in a car,
right?
And the lights are flashing by and you're moving forward. But meanwhile, the whole song is about reflecting backward.
It's true, and it's a particularly European take on America that they give us. This is like a Helmut Newton or Guy Bourdain photo come to life, right?
Oh,
that's
yeah,
where the theatricality, the glam comes in.
And I'm thinking about it, the inventiveness of a Roxy song, not only like Ladytron, the textures of that, but a song like Remake Remodel, where they're talking about that car, driving away, and what's driving away,
and
from
lust
me.
For when a car,
I, when am I leaving behind? They're leaving behind their youth, and it
Faces,
sounds,
another great song.
Misery, Remember Me, it's a song that also resonates with me, despite the somewhat melancholy feel. There's a line in there, there's a light, can you see it? There's a light, I can feel it. They may be a little bit distressed about this midlife crossroads that they're at, but they're moving ahead. They're going to see what's next on the horizon.
Well, and
that's what's made them a really interesting band.
It touches again of the post-pandemic album, A Happy Return to Life. This is probably the happiest record in the Ladytron catalog. I go back to 2001 when the Chicago label Carrot Top included one of their covers of Human League on a tribute record.
Yeah.
If Human League had continued beyond the point where it ended too soon, you'd have a great pop band like Ladytron.
Yeah, there you go. Human League was a great underrated band. They had a few hits, but those early records were fantastic.
All right, that's what we think of the new music from Ladytron and Iggy Pop, and now we want to hear from you. Leave us a voice message with your thoughts at soundopinions.org. Coming up, we dive into the history and music of the Chicago indie label Cranky Records, which is really the story of running an indie label, period, on Sound Opinions.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. This week we're talking about the Chicago indie label Cranky Records. It was founded in 1993 and over the years developed a small but mighty stable of artists ranging from Deer Hunter to Low to Godspeed You Black Emperor. And today we'll be talking with one of the men who started Cranky.
Greg, we are going to welcome to the show Bruce Adams, who has written a fine new book, You're With Stupid. Bruce, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm going to say right up top before we get any deeper, and I don't want to be insulting at all, Cranky Records was a marginal indie label, a great indie label, put out some great, great music. I never thought I'd see a history of it, but your book is so much more. It's really a history of independent music and spirit and entrepreneurship in a period in the 90s, not just in Chicago. It's a great Chicago story, but you really cover that whole mindset kind of nationwide, worldwide. Is that what you set out to do?
Yes. Yes, it was. As my wife told me shortly after I sold my share of Cranky, someone has to tell the story. Someone needs to record what was happening, not just at the record label, but the sort of the whole ecosystem we were working within. As the years went by, I realized I had been involved in this amazingly fertile, productive, and collaborative musical environment in the city and beyond, and that it should be recorded, that the achievements of all the people involved needed to be recognized and put down on paper or on pixels. It was just a matter of when the opportunity came up that I could do it. In 2019, Jessica Hopper, the fantastic writer, with her aid, I was able to put together something, and I took it from there. It was never work I wanted to do on spec. With all the people I was talking with and dependent on, I wanted to be able to assure them that their contributions would end up in something. It's been an amazing process.
You know, it's a needed book, Bruce. I think it's the first one really to sort of dive into that era in a really comprehensive way, which was unexpected. Cranky, to my mind, deserves a book because of its place in the music firmament, if you will. Definitely unique. So what I think what you nailed in the book was that in Chicago, there were a number of independent labels. They're doing pretty amazing work, putting out music that wasn't just of the moment, but designed to be listened to in future decades and still hold up, which was very different from the mindset that you would find in, say, L.A. or New York or Nashville to this day, really. Because you came here to Chicago from Michigan, right, and started this label. And I know that you had a background at Touch and Go Records, which in some ways was sort of the godfather label of all of this, right? What was that experience like at Touch and Go, and how did it influence what you ended up doing it with Cranky starting in 1993?
Touch and Go was an immersion in the world of independent record labels and distribution, led by two people, Corey Rusk and his wife at the time, Lisa Rusk. And working alongside them was just a constant education in how to operate, how to treat musicians and treat all the people you came into contact, whether it was someone running a fanzine or someone booking shows, how to develop an aesthetic and carry out that aesthetic. So I mentioned in the book a little bit about the conditions I worked under, working at first in their house. It was just a fantastic formative experience. I'd been a super fan of the label. I was in Ann Arbor. I was roading for the Laughing Hyenas, whom I had an immense amount of respect and affection for. I thought they were one of the preeminent rock bands operating at the time, and I've always thought so since. And so I wanted to move, and the opportunity came along to work at Touch and Go and also at Kaleidoscope Distribution in Des Plaines. So I jumped on it. I started off putting things in order on shelves and packing promo items. And from that point, I went to working as the promo guy, and I learned a lot. To paraphrase Chuck D, my Rolodex weighed a ton by the time I walked out of that out of that experience.
Well, you know, Bruce, you mentioned working for the distributor Kaleidoscope. You also worked for Cargo. I think a lot of people don't understand circa physical product, vinyl and CDs, how difficult it was for independent small labels and independent bands to get their music to the record stores. If you're living in Ann Arbor, you just walk into the store. You're living in Chicago, you just walk into the store, right? But otherwise, how do you get the three or four copies that devotees will want to the stores? And there are horror stories in the book about the world of distribution. Touch and Go was a great label that for a long time treated people very fairly, everybody who worked for them, everybody who dealt with them. But you had heard more than enough horror stories and had firsthand miserable experiences with this world of selling music. By the time you start Cranky in the book in 93, you're like, what the hell were you thinking? Why do you want to get into this?
My partner Joel Eschke and I were a couple of opinionated, stubborn, focused guys. We felt like between my experiences at Kaleidoscope and our mutual experiences at Cargo, we'd sort of seen how to do everything wrong.
You knew, we knew what not to do.
In the book, I go into a little bit about what we call the cranky commandments, which were aesthetic and business rules for us. And it was all thou shalt not. But I think what was the Hunter Thompson quote, the music business is a long, fetid pit.
Rabid weasels in the pit. Yeah. I mean, apparently he never actually wrote that, but it's such a good quote. He should have. Yes.
You know, we'd seen what people with bad intentions and what people with good intentions were doing and how it worked out and how it didn't work out. By the time I was working at Cargo, we were entering the high water phase of alternative rock and indie rock. Cargo had a couple of big selling bands, Rocket from the Crypt and Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet. They should have been grazing in green grass, but instead they sank even more money into more records and more labels. You know, it was an illustrative moment for us when we started our own label. Plus, we were young. I was capable of stretching out that paycheck till the, you know, the ramen noodles the night before payday. We were willing to make sacrifices to do what we did, and we understood that there were no guarantees. By the time it came around that we could actually earn a living at the label, Joel and I were probably more surprised than anybody else.
Well, you mentioned the word aesthetic before, and it was one of the cranky commandments: focus on what you're good on, what you believe in. And, you know, for lack of a better word, with bands like Le Bradford, the first release that really kind of put you on the map, Godspeed, You Black Emperor, Low, Jessamine, I would say it was a sort of, you know, these words were so meaningless at the time. And you and I, Greg, as the daily newspaper critics, were scoffing at post-rock, right? What does that mean? I my entry into Cranky and its world was Le Bradford and Jessamine and that love of those analog synthesizers. Which you put in context in the book. Stereo Lab was doing it. There were other bands rediscovering these machines. Golden moment there. Lasted about 4 years. You could buy a used Micro Moog or even a Memory Moog for a couple $100, right? And now suddenly they're worth more than your car. But there was a moment where nobody wanted these machines, and you guys were fascinated in that futuristic, low-tech sound. How would you, though, describe the cranky aesthetic? Because it came through in the album covers, in the bands you signed, in the artwork, in the ads, in everything Cranky did.
Well, there's always what I would call the "what do you tell your mother" line. I would tell my mom it's about mood, often referring to the cinematic. And by the cinematic, I would say everything from, say, John Barry soundtracks. To more esoteric stuff. A lot of the bands, I think, and a lot of the individual musicians were interested in the sort of the Venn diagram where 60s psychedelia, for lack of a better word, the funk jazz of Miles Davis, things like that all intersected. You mentioned Jessamine before, and what was interesting to me is at the time I looked at all the bands on the label and I saw a spectrum. You know, and one side was almost pure ambience, say like Stars of the Lid. And at the other side was Jessamine, who had more of a rhythmic element to them, a very rhythmic element. A lot of references to stuff. And so the bands played with that spectrum, and that's sort of what we considered to be our corner of the street. very early in the process, we'd come across just an amazingly kick-ass yet ramshackle rock band from Columbus called Monster Truck 5. And if they had some personal issues, it prevented them from recording. But if we had done something with them, things might have worked out differently. I hate to use the experimental word, because Joel and I always said the experiments end when you press record. but there was this willingness of all the musicians, a curiosity and an interest in either stretching out the boundaries of rock music as it existed, or maybe chopping them up and remixing them.
Well, it was interesting, I think, too, the guitar-centric nature of indie rock at the time, right? I mean, it's rock, it's guitars. That's what everybody kind of equated it with. And it seemed like you guys were, everybody else is doing that. We're going to carve out our own lane. I mean, even a band like Jessamine, which is probably more traditional in terms of sound, in that there is a guitar, right? But they didn't sound like any of the other Seattle bands that they were surrounded by. So it seemed like you were conscious of what was happening in indie music at the time and thought, well, this whole lane is there to be taken. Is that pretty much it? Or
it was a case of, we were working at a distributor, and as I write in the book, your colleague Bill Meyer wrote that at a certain point in time, he dreaded 7-inch singles mailers in his mailbox. There was a glut epitomized to me by, I don't know if you remember, a band called Sammy that were almost a pavement doppelganger. So there's a lot of stuff coming in that, and we understood two things. We had to differentiate ourselves somehow from the glut. And if there were good rock bands in Chicago, they were going to be snatched up very quickly by labels like Touch and Go or Drag City, who were established and who could offer them more. We were basically asking the first group of musicians we worked with to step off the ledge with us. So we were thinking about something different. We had the desire to start a record label. Joel had had the desire for a long time. We didn't quite know where to begin. And then one day, the first Le Bradford single shows up at Cargo. And shortly after he opened the box almost, Joel motioned me into his office, into the buyer's office. And I went in there and we listened to it. And the both of us were like, holy cow. This references so many things we love, but it's completely different than everything else that's coming in through the doors.
I actually dug up my review of that record. I don't think the term post-rock was even in the ether at that point, but it was clearly different. And I spent a paragraph just trying to describe what was going on there that was clearly coming from like three or four different areas of music and putting them together in a really amazing way. That distinctiveness, it must have been, as an aesthetic, a guy with aesthetics, it must have been incredible to hear that. But then as a businessman, how do you turn around and sell that when there's no pocket? Go buy more of that. You didn't have that with a band like Le Bradford, right?
There were precursors. There were sort of established little veins that people could pick out if they wanted to, or if they were familiar with. If you knew sort of the background of industrial music, whether it's some aspects of Throbbing Gristle, Soviet France a lot. There were things going on at smaller record labels across the country, you know, sort of the beginnings of what you might call dark ambient now, that some people were aware of, could say, this is like Arcane Device or PGR or whatever. There was a whole movement around industrial tape music, and Le Bradford sort of touched on that a little bit. That was the beauty of the band. And especially as they evolved over time, you could even say, oh, they're from Virginia. I hear some mountain music in there. You know, I hear the High Lonely. So we were fortunate in that we worked with them. You know, Carter Brown, the keyboard player for the band, played organ in church. Those things they touched on, the music of Arvo Part. I go into a big deal early in the book about ECM records and ECM cutouts and how many people had access to those. Even if you were familiar, say, with Bill Frisell or John Abercrombie, much less Arvo Pärt, you might have been familiar with that. So in a way, there was a mood that they tapped into that a good number of people were familiar with. And then you know, scarcity creates demand. So you put out a record on transparent green vinyl in an edition of 500. You know, it gets people's interest.
Coming up next, we talk with Bruce Adams about what it was like to coexist with major labels in the 90s when they suddenly took an interest in signing indie artists. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. And we're back. This week, we're talking with author and co-founder of Cranky Records, Bruce Adams. Let's get back into the conversation.
Did you have to buy your Le Bradford record, Greg?
I don't recall. I do remember it showing up one day, and I think Bruce had given me a call. I mean, I tried to interview Bruce a few times. It was hard to get the guy on the phone. But
well, I figured, you know, Bruce and Joel were living the Cranky name and aesthetic, right? So I had called Bruce. I'm writing my first book, A History of Psychedelia, and I'm deep in the Krautrock chapter, and I'm dealing with Faust and bands like this. And I'd heard, I think I was in Secondhand Tunes, and I heard a Le Bradford record. I said, who is this, right? Chicago Labor. So I called Bruce. I said, can I have a copy? He said, no. Because he'd been to a dive diner, which is no longer there. It was with Jim's on Irving.
And we read your Heart interview.
He's sitting at the counter reading my review. I had to go review Heart at the Riviera Theater. I got, you know, a baby boomer editor wants me to go review Heart, Jim. It's a living, brother. You're packing Stone Temple Pilots records at Cargo, you know. The irony there is I had to prove I was cool enough to get on the Cranky Cranky man, which was fine. I told him in the book, I told him at the time, I'll sell one of these three copies of crappy major label junk I got and trade it in. I would do that all the time. Out with the Stone Temple Pilots and in with the Stereolab Import.
No, it was a hurdle, but not a great
hurdle. Well, the reason I bring this up is the irony of, you know, when you were major label critics, Greg and I were having to hear Godspeed You Black Emperor or Low's debut in the context of everything that was happening in alternative rock, and everything that was happening, and the bands that just wouldn't go away.
Yeah.
You know, the new Styx record or whatever, right? You know, we had to cover the waterfront. What you do in You're With Stupid is zoom out. Now, obviously, you were a super fan. 9 out of 10 of the names you've mentioned so far in this chat, people won't know, which is good. They'll have to go discover some of this music if they're intrigued. You and Joel were living deep in this aesthetic, deep in this indie world, but the book zooms out and puts everything in context. What was happening in the alternative feeding frenzy of all those major label talent scouts descending on Chicago with the gold Amex cards, right? What was happening with the Urge Overkills getting signed and all of that craziness, Liz Phair, and just the whole how indie was operating ethically, aesthetically, in response to the craziness of an era. That era of indie no longer exists, and that era of major label money-making no longer exists either. So it's a capsule history. Same way I would go from reviewing Heart to reviewing Le Bradford.
What's interesting now is, of course, everybody can be a major daily newspaper critic, right? Everybody has access to everything in the world if they so desire. When I talk about Heart or Stone Temple Pilots or any of these bands, we were the beneficiaries of that because record stores don't stay open unless a lot of people are buying major label stuff in quantity. And that in turn allows record stores to stock more esoteric things.
Yeah, when grandma comes in and buys Hootie and the Blowfish, it's good for that store.
Yeah, it's good. I worked in a record store. I get the dynamic there. You know, we were definitely the long tail. But it was also, especially in Chicago at that time, it was an atmosphere where it seemed like any label that did a couple shows at Phyllis's Musical Inn or something could sign a major label contract, or established bands on independent labels were getting courted. I remember the Laughing Hyenas telling me they were taken out to dinner by American Records.
Weirder thing, you know, Butthole Surfers were on Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It was a free-for-all.
David Yao told me a story once that they were getting courted by the labels, and he said the bottle of wine that the A&R guy bought us at that dinner cost more than my car. that I had just bought.
David Yao of Jesus Lizard.
David Yao of the Jesus Lizard. And the Jesus Lizard did get signed. And David Yao said he bought a house because he got some money from Capitol Records or whatever. And then they went, you know, then they got dropped, you know.
But if you are going to make that move like the Jesus Lizard did, it's very helpful to have a member of the band who's an accountant, which Dave Sims was. They were able to make a good decision with their money. You know, I talk a little bit in the book about Dave Trumfio and the Pulsars. You know, Dave plowed his advance money back into his studio, and that's how he makes a living now. It was an atmosphere conducive to people being exploited or to for people to reach for a brass ring that wasn't really there. You know, it trickled down to the independent labels too. You know, there are plenty of independent labels pissing money away, signing too many bands, going for big South by Southwest showcases, doing a bunch of stuff that in our opinion and in our experience was vainglorious and wasteful.
Well, and you know, Cranky, Drag City, Thrill Jockey, Bloodshot were not mistreating their artists for the most part. But Legion are the indie labels that were just as bad as the majors in terms of screwing over. Replacements have stories. Husker Du has stories. Minutemen, you know, all those bands.
Yeah, there were, you know, tons of fly-by-night record labels. You know, I worked at a distributor. I was a salesperson. I had a desk. And on that desk were a pile of promos, you know, from various independent record labels. And I could see the ones who were airdropping promo CDs like it was, they were bombing Da Nang in 1968.
All of which the band is going to pay for.
Right. The band pays for those things, whether you work for it, whether you do it for an independent label or a major label. I'm not flattering myself or Joel by saying we kept our heads, because there were other people who did as well and were able to emerge from it better off. And also, you know, you had the incredible benefit of having Touch and Go moving into distribution, taking over distribution for a bunch of other indie labels, and shepherding them through the process and guaranteeing a resilient ecosystem.
Yeah, it was the ecosystem was incredible. You know, I remember talking to Corey Rusk once, and the whole idea of the 50-50 split with the label and the artist making as much as the label did when a record was put out, which was, you know, majors weren't doing that. Just about every label in Chicago kind of copied that aesthetic, we're going to do that too. And they all thrived. And then you would sign bands, you know, like La Bradford, who had lengthy career, Low, who was unsigned after a brief dalliance with a major label, and you kind of revived their thing. Godspeed You, Black Emperor, I remember you guys signing them, this band that had independently released their record in Canada with four songs on it, I believe, that were all 10 plus minutes long, right? Am I got that right? There's not a radio hit on that record, but that band has just gotten huge. And kind of like you saw something there, that band was there for somebody to pick up, and you guys saw them. What was it like, Bruce, tell what that experience was like with Godspeed You, Black Emperor, because they were not a household name at the time.
First of all, if I had a dollar for everybody who told me they were at the first Godspeed You, Black Emperor show at the Lounge Acts, I wouldn't have to work ever again in my life. We saw two things. One, musically, they had this powerful command of ebb and flow, even at the beginning. And then two, I saw in them what I saw in the Butthole Surfers when they were on Touch and Go before they went to a major label, even before I moved to Chicago, that they were road warriors. The Buttholes lived out of a camper van for like 2 or 3 years, would stop off at the Greystone in Detroit, which was the venue that Corey and Lisa Rusk ran, and they would hunker down there for a couple weeks, clean up, get some good food, hang out, and then go back out on the road again. The Godspeed had the same commitment to live performance. You know, the records are great then and now, but they predominantly were focused on the live show. And I saw that in them. And to be honest, at the time, most of the Cranky bands were not into touring. Those that were had significant challenges, beer drinking, sausage party, alt rock atmosphere.
Yeah.
Didn't always go over well, but Godspeed, just through sheer power, we took them out to dinner that first night at the Lounge Acts, and two or three of the people in the band were like, can you just save something for us? We're going to go busk by the hour.
Always working. Yeah. Always working.
Always working.
Yeah.
Always into performance. That's what brought them together as individuals into this crazy collective. You know, it just built up very steadily from that. There's some great passages in the book, some great interviews, especially with Dave from Godspeed about their first exposure to music in England, the dynamic of the English press, and how the band sort of got a rocket tied to them and took off from there.
Looking at Pitchfork Festival and looking at the present, I expected nostalgia in your With Stupid. It's not. Nostalgia is the kiss of death of all great art, as my friends in Wire said. It's a history. It's journalistic. You have some great interviews. You have a lot of facts that I didn't know, even covering that scene at that time. Where do we stand today? And what can the current music world, I mean, indie's a meaningless word now. There are still some major label acts. There's still stuff that's promoted that way, but everybody else essentially is their own master. So Bruce Adams, with the benefit of 30 years of living music and running, you know, a business, a great label, what's it look like to you now?
I want to say that when I wrote the book, I really did not want to be either nostalgic or condescending toward people in the present. I'm 62 years old. I went to college in the late 70s. I was surrounded by boomers who were always telling me how great it was and how great they were and what they did. And I did not want to grow up to be a kind of older person.
You
like
missed
that.
Everything because you weren't at Woodstock. Nothing you ever have is going to be, yeah, I know, our whole lives.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you don't see the book in light of some sort of you kids missed all the fun, because I really did not want to do that. And in many ways, just for example, I live in Urbana now and I look north to Chicago and I'd say, great googly moogly. No. The dear departed Jamie Branch, Lifeguard, Horse Girl, the incredible jazz scene that, you know, now has transcended a lot of the racial barriers that existed when I was there in the 90s. You know, and occasionally, like, Tamika Reid has been down here and performed, and it's just like, good Lord, you know, the fire continues. But it's a big challenge for musicians now in the post-COVID world. Massive challenge. I feel like there are a lot of people who talk about a new business paradigm, and these people have never done any, you know, and these people's model for successful business is their lemonade stand. Mom gives me the lemonade, and I sit there, and I get the money. Why don't you understand the new paradigm? The new paradigm is I get everything I want, and you get no money. I don't know. I think a physical media is still important. It's the one way that groups can and musicians can make some money, either selling it at a record store or selling it on tour. The network that was built up in the late 80s and 90s has, you know, been ravaged, whether it's independent record stores closing or distributors shutting down. That can slowly be rebuilt, but it'll be at a, you know, a less complete level. It'll be more tenuous and smaller than it was. The major labels have finally ridded themselves of the troublesome need to sell things to people. From my perspective, I don't, you know, Spotify is bleeding money like crazy. Nobody gets any money from it. Yeah, things are grim. In some ways, I think a lot of people that, I don't know how it was for you, Phyllis, but for me in college, go out to see a band at a bar and they're doing covers and maybe they'll sneak in one of their own songs if they had that kind of audacity. You know, the idea of going out and seeing self-produced, self-generated music, at least in the rock world for brand new bands, is not a new thing. You know, in a way, the underground is going to reconstruct itself at some level, and it can be done. And it is being done by a lot of people, you know, far more involved than me. But it's going to be, it's going to be a struggle, and it will be much different than the world I describe in the book, even given you know, the economics of it, even given that, you know, we were working in a boom town time. So I'm always optimistic because I see people all the time that love music and are willing to do something to advance it. My concern is how do new groups evolve and work in this atmosphere, and how do they develop the wherewithal to carry on?
Well, we've been talking to Bruce Adams. The new book is fantastic. Even if you don't know Cranky Records, don't think you're interested. It is the history of a period in an engaging and often amusing voice. You're with Stupid. I say those bumper stickers, those stickers that Cranky would crank out. That was the attitude. You're with Stupid. Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you, gents. Thank you for all you do.
Oh, you are most welcome. That wraps up our discussion about Cranky Records, and as always, we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite Cranky release? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Greg, what do we got on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to dig deep to unearth some more buried treasures, music flying under the mainstream radar that we think you need to know about. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.